The Institute on Religious Life presents a retape of a talk originally given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., on the subject of the power of the will in religious life. We will continue to have the substitute voice because of the poor quality of the master tape which Father Hardin originally made. Again, we repeat that the words, the thoughts, the ideas are those of Father John A. Hardin, nothing added, nothing subtracted. In beginning this lecture on the power of the will, Father Hardin first asked if there were any reflections, observations, or questions. There were two nuns who had an observation to make concerning this subject. The first nun wished to point out the difficulty of getting women to be really women of their word. As she stated, so often we know what we want to do, but when the bind is on, that will doesn't come into full pledge so that we will be true to ourselves. The second nun observed that in this matter of the power of the will, this has to start from the time that we are children, the training of the will. Otherwise, people simply do not have control over their will. Father Hardin certainly concurred, indicating that early training of the will has a lot to do with the way the person behaves in later life. This was followed by a question from a brother, stated as follows: Father, how can we develop a moral certitude in someone who is very uncertain because of sins of their past life? And Father's reply: moral certitude. This is not directly on the subject, is it? It's all right. I just want to make sure. I want to make sure that the audience understands. How do you develop moral certitude in a person who has had, say, a bad past moral life? Now, first of all, they should come clean about their past. It is remarkable how many people are concerned about their past because they're not sure that they've made a clean sweep or a confession of everything. In teaching priests to hear confessions in general, and general confessions in particular, we advise them for a person, say, who has never made a general confession or doesn't know how to start, to ask the person, before you say anything else from your past life, is there anything in your past life that you did not confess? And we tell them, you may be surprised, especially among women, so that there may be a reason for being bothered about the past. They may not have made a full, clear, complete confession. I recommend, and St. Ignatius requires it of us, I recommend in every religious community that the person make a general confession, at least. And at least before their first vows, or better, before they become novices. Now, there is no way you can ask a person to sign on the dotted line or have the priest confessor sign a document, Sister So-and-so made her general confession, and then have it signed Father John Smith. No. So you have to trust that they have done so. All right. That's one thing. And even if they think they've made a complete coverage of their past life, in their past confessions. There may be things about which they're insecure or worried, and so on. They're given extraordinary grace when they enter the religious life, which you should bank on, and ask them to tell all, if they want to. Don't require it. If they want to, they may write it out and read it, or have you read it. Sometimes it is easier for the priest to read it in the presence, in their presence, silently, of course, and then give the pages back to them. Mind you, never require anything written for confession, a good general rule. But it may be recommended, or they may be encouraged to do so, if they find it hard to remember, or especially spell out some sordid feature of their past life. So one is to make a clean sweep. Am I clear? The sooner they do so, the better. So they should be given some time when they enter the postulancy to kind of get their bearings. Secondly, I think early in the spiritual life, in the religious life, the one who enters should make a full retreat. I cannot tell you how practically useful a good retreat is within a month or two of becoming a religious. Now, you may want to wait a little longer, but not too much longer. A retreat is a time of special grace, a time of silence, and can help to set the person for life later on. Thirdly, suppose the person is still evidently bothered by their past life. Well, get them to talk without seeming to pry. I understand nowadays people are quite willing to talk about their past. Am I correct? Get them to reveal, and you make at least a mental note. It is not a good idea ever to take written notes while a person is speaking confidentially, right? You place a barrier between the person and yourself. And try to help them to find out what's bothering them, because either their fear or their insecurity is rational or it is not. That's a complete disjunction, right? Either rational or it is not. Find out if it's rational. In other words, do they believe that their sins are so grave they couldn't be forgiven? Are they afraid they've got themselves into such bad habits that they won't be able to get over them? Are they concerned that they will be exposed to temptations similar to the ones they had before and will fall? Are they so overwhelmed by the sublimity of the life they're entering that they just can't picture themselves, me, living the kind of life that my rule and religious state require? Well, those are what I would call rational fears. They add up. Cope with them. Try to answer them. If you find out, in spite of all your efforts to get them over their insecurity about their past, that you are striking out, not getting anywhere, suggest that they consult someone whose judgment you trust, who may help them. People in that second state may have deep, sub, or unconscious sources of fear that you may not be able to ferret out. People like that should not be allowed to take their first vows unless and until they have at least somehow mastered that insecurity. And I would suggest, as I've mentioned before, more than once, early formation should not be spiritual therapy. Otherwise, by the time they take their vows, well, that's just where they're supposed to be beginning. They should begin their novitiate all over again. All you've been coping with is their problem. So if nothing else, you may have delayed their formation by 2 or 3 years by coping with their hidden problems. Now for our subject regarding the power of the will in religious life. What are some of the aspects of the power of the will in religious life? First, we should recognize and so teach those under our care that the spiritual life is a result of two forces cooperating, not just one: divine grace and the human will. Among the spiritual axioms that you have heard, I repeat one because it happens to be Saint Ignatius who summarizes what I am saying here. Quote, "Work, use your will as though everything depended on you, and pray as though everything depended on God," end quote. In other words, it's neither grace alone nor will alone that you'll make for sanctity. It is both. Secondly, be sure that you are clear. Then teach others that just because they have a will or willpower doesn't mean that they know how to use it. There are all kinds of willful people in this world, and they are not all saints. It is not just willpower. It's the right kind of willpower. Thirdly, in order to use my will as I should and become the religious that I ought to, I must know with my mind what my will should embrace. Hence the importance of knowing the truth of God's revealed word, knowing the truth of the church's teaching, knowing the truth of my community. Because in the absence of these three, in the absence of the truth, strong-willed people may use their will on all sorts of either wrong things or unimportant things. As one sister pointed out, the fundamentalists can be very strict. Well, we wish that more people were strict about the right things. So the truth, the will is a blind faculty. It must be enlightened by the mind. The mind must know the truth and present the truth to the will as something good. Otherwise, the will is like a giant going around and not knowing what to do, or like the car with a steering wheel out of order. Where do you go? The will needs an object. The will needs a purpose. The will needs a cause. The will needs a motive. And that motive is what the mind, having learned about what God teaches, what the church teaches, what my community approved by the church teaches, these are the things I should use my willpower on. I think a lot of people waste a lot of willpower. Now, number four, not only does the will, in order to be exercised the way it should, need to know what to choose and what to love, which are the functions of the will, to choose and to love. This is my definition of loving. Love, for me, is sustained choice. I keep choosing that which I love. I choose, and I keep choosing it, and I keep loving it. So the will must be enlightened in order to know what it is to choose. Otherwise, it can be choosing all sorts of strange things or loving things it shouldn't love. Fifth, and this is the big one, our human nature is a fallen human nature. We somehow have the idea that because we have a fallen human nature, therefore only our flesh is fallen, that we have only passions of the body. Not so. Human nature is fallen, not just the body. That means the soul. We have a fallen human soul. Honest. Honest. Our intellects are darkened and our wills are weakened because they are fallen. This power of the will is a weakened power. Or a person may throw his or her weight around, may be blustering or bully-like. Willpower is not just power. It is power used in the right way. In order to use this willpower in the right way, I need help from God. And therefore, prayer. A constant life of prayer in order to strengthen this weakened, fallen human will. And this is necessary. Otherwise, religious will go around willing all kinds of things. Why? Because they want what they want. Not having been helped by grace to will what they should, even what they don't like, they will what they like. They will what they choose. There are two main reasons that we need God's grace to help our fallen wills. One is to want to give up or sacrifice what we like. We must want to, otherwise you don't do it. The essence of sacrifice is in the will. You don't naturally want to give up what we like. We need grace. Two, we do not naturally want to endure what we dislike. For that, we need grace. The main source of grace is prayer. As we know, possession, let alone progress in religious life, even having some semblance of sanctity, once we reach the age of reason, and certainly to grow in it, we need both divine grace and the free will. What do we need most, the free will or grace to grow in sanctity? Only God knows we need both. Since the Reformation, however, as all the great masters of the spiritual life during the 16th century mentioned, and to mention just two, Teresa of Avila and Ignatius of Loyola, they all insisted on man's cooperation through freedom or with freedom in a way that the Church in her previous centuries had never emphasized before. Because whatever else happened in the 16th century, the one thing most significant for our purpose has been the entrance of an erroneous ideology, namely that system of thought calling itself Christian, which denies even the existence, let alone the need, for man's free cooperation with God's grace. Protestantism is that system of Christian thought which claims that divine grace can neither be cooperated with or resisted. To question that, to not know that, is not to know the Western post-Reformation world. At its profoundest depth, human freedom, real internal freedom, was denied by all the major reformers and has entered all the structures, cultures, and institutions of the Western world. Given that fact, I would say that whatever else those over whom you have some either authority or charge should be seen as people who have been infected by the virus of determinism. Where determinism means that man's life and lot in this world is quite foreordained, either fixed by God in the original Protestant sense, or somehow determined by forces outside of the man. Our modern psychologists have reduced it to the new Holy Trinity: heredity, environment, and education. People are what they are because of their ancestry, the environment in which they are brought up and lived, and their education. I would then stress the importance in dealing with people who are products of this culture. Stress, because assume they have been duly and deeply affected by modern determinism to a point where you wonder who any longer really makes, I don't say in a day, but even in a week or a month, really makes an honest, sincere, interior decision. Socialism and communism needed 400 years of Protestantism as a prelude where the state and the society does everything for you. So that does not mean, to say the least, that we understress the importance, even greater importance, objectively, of divine grace. Nor can we presume on that grace. But even there, even divine grace will not come automatically. Even there, we must use our free will in its highest single function, to pray. People must want to pray. Even the grace is not predetermined. Now, this concludes Father John Hardin's talk on the power of the will in religious life.